You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
During her second year of college, Sarah Manguso developed a debilitating blood disease, an autoimmune disorder so rare that it doesn't even have an official name. It took her 4 years to fully recover, and that's the subject of her new memoir, The Two Kinds of Decay, an account of her experience that she tells with dark humor and sharp observation. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it brings Sarah Manguso to the show today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What were the first symptoms of the disease?
Well, the very first symptoms came in a constellation of about three. The first thing I noticed was that when I awoke one morning, my feet were asleep. And, identifying as a healthy person, it was very easy for me to say, well, you know, I'm tired, or, you know, my position must have been strange as I slept. And I walked to...
Well, and you'd been healthy up to this moment.
I'd been quite healthy. You know, I had been running 3 miles several times that very week. And I walked to the bathroom, and my feet stayed asleep. It was kind of an interesting feeling. But again, I was only tired. And when I attempted to wash my face, it felt as if I was almost about to drown. I couldn't hold my breath. I couldn't hold my breath for the amount of time that it takes to splash water on a face. But again, I thought, you know, I'm tired. I thought of a whole list of excuses.
And then eventually, of course, you went to a doctor because it lingered.
It lingered. And
what did they think it was? This is a very rare condition.
Well, the chronic form of the disease is quite rare, but I was lucky enough to be taken to a teaching hospital in Boston, and I was actually diagnosed in the emergency room in about half an hour. I was treated by an ER doctor who called a friend of his who was a neurologist on the phone, and he came back into my ward and said, I have to check your reflexes. And when he hit my knee with the mallet, there were no reflexes there. And that was it. That was my diagnosis.
So you were very lucky that you weren't misdiagnosed so often the case in things like this. And the name of that they give this is, forgive me if I get it wrong, chronic idiopathic demyelinating polyradioneuropathy?
Yeah, that's very close. And that's not, in fact, what they told me I had that day in the ER. The monophasic, or the non-chronic form of the disease, is named after two French doctors, as many diseases are named after. Doctors are famous patients. And so my diagnosis was Guillain-Barré syndrome.
Oh, we've heard of Guillain-Barré.
Which we've heard of course. But if it lasts 4 months and nothing seems to be working, I got upgraded into the chronic form.
So they treated you for Guillain-Barré.
They did.
What is the treatment?
Well, at that point, the treatment was different from the current treatment. The main treatment I was receiving was called apheresis, which in a hospital setting just means separation of the blood, discarding of the diseased component, and then reinfusing of the non-sick parts of the blood with some other liquids to make up the blood volume.
Which most people have heard of as cleaning out the blood.
Cleaning the blood, of course.
And then it didn't correct the situation. Did it get any better?
Well, it got much better temporarily, because the source of my problem was that my immune system was secreting an antibody that was attacking a part of my body, the peripheral nervous system. That's how all autoimmune diseases work.
And you write that autoimmune diseases invoke the metaphor of suicide. Your body is killing itself?
Yeah. I mean, it really is hard to avoid that cliche when thinking and talking about it for an extended period of time. You know, something's happening on the inside of me that's trying to kill me.
Well, you also got depressed. Now, I can imagine somebody getting depressed because the thing wasn't going away. But was the depression because of an emotional thing? Was it because it's also connected to this condition? Or did the drugs that they used to treat it also cause depression as a side effect?
I would have to say the answer to all of those questions is yes, sort of. And depression is, it's very difficult to come up with a true cause-effect relation between cause of depression and depression. It's not like I scraped my hand. Here, I'm bleeding. I'm abraded. My depression may have sort of skulked around my life before I got sick, but I would have to say that it must have been a combination of being sick for so long, having to drop out of school, having to just be in rehab more or less alone, and having to take prednisone, a steroid, for 4.5 years, which is notorious for triggering all sorts of mood disorders. All of those things together probably are what did it.
Well, you got a number of steroids. You got corticosteroids as well, didn't you?
Yes. Prednisone is actually just one particular corticosteroid.
And interferon?
Interferon
is
not a steroid.
Toxic.
Yeah, interferon is actually a substance that's produced in the body naturally, but in large, I hope I have that right, but in large concentrations, it's used to treat blood diseases and other diseases where the immune system is misbehaving.
Did the side effects make it difficult for you to see the drugs as helping you fight the disease and save your life?
Intellectually... And at this point in my life, I was very rigidly rational. I was a college student. I knew everything would be okay. I was capable of all things. And so, yes, you know, I even viewed the worst of my treatments, the most difficult and uncomfortable of my treatments, as things that were going to make me stronger, because I was 21 years old. And, you know, that's what life is about, isn't it? It was about becoming stronger and better.
My guest is Sarah Manguso, whose book, The Two Kinds of Decay, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Were you already thinking of being a writer at this point?
In fact, I wasn't. I got to college thinking that I'd be a doctor, like all good middle-class kids.
And I would have thought that this would have driven you further into that.
Well, life became more interesting once I got sick. I had a lot of time to really just sit and think. And with so little content in the average day, I didn't have a lot of external prodding or stimulus. And so I think that's when I sort of started becoming a writer.
And a poet, and a very fine writer. I mean, this book is beautifully written.
Thank
Usually
you.
People who write this well have been doing it since they were very young.
Well, it is my fourth book. It's my most visible book because it's with a different press. But my first three books were collections, two poetry collections and a collection of very short stories. So I had been practicing writing short pieces before.
I'd imagine now that I think of it that seeing a doctor, if you'd gone to medical school, seeing a doctor after everything that you'd been through might almost be a bit scary. I don't want to see them anymore.
Well, yes, it was about 2 years since my last hospitalization before I was willing to even see a doctor.
And you were hospitalized not just for this condition, but then for the depression.
Yeah, that happened about four and a half years into the experience.
And one of the ways that you were dealing with it on your own was by drinking?
Well, it wasn't, again, it wasn't that clear a cause-effect relationship. I think if it had been, I would have quit drinking earlier, but...
Well, self-medication is not unique to people who have real problems.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, I wouldn't even say I have real problems now, but self-medication is definitely part of every day. Healthier choices, though. Well... The drinking is something that I became aware of only once the awareness of my disease as my sort of primary character trait started to fade. And it was 9 years after the diagnosis that I decided, after what I describe in the book as an unstable euphoria, a period of unstable euphoria, in which drinking played a role, that... my disease wasn't my biggest problem anymore. Drinking was my biggest problem. And I actually had that that what seemed like a bit of an arbitrary decision endorsed by a friend of mine who had thyroid cancer. And after 11 years of prednisone and, you know, having the cancer identity, she just decided that her obesity, which had been brought on by all sorts of drugs she had been taking, was a bigger problem than her cancer. And that was when she was better.
Is it hard? I think it's hard for some people to talk about illness without being sentimental and very emotional, but you write in a very straightforward, almost detached way. Is that to distance yourself from your body in a kind of a clinical way, or to try to put this whole thing into perspective?
Well, I definitely wanted to make sense of the experience. I wanted to understand it. And that was my primary impulse behind starting to think and to write about it. I wasn't necessarily trying to be detached, to limit my emotional involvement with what I was writing. I wanted to be emotionally involved, but the line between being emotional and being sentimental, I guess it's a blurry one, but it was one that I definitely resisted crossing.
Well, looking back at this, some of the things that you had to endure are quite, well, I mean, I'm not sure how well I would have held up to them. You had a Hickman catheter implanted in your chest, a permanent IV line for your apheresis treatments. And you had to live with that.
Yeah, I had that for 11 and a half months to the day.
Did you have to learn to care for that sort of thing by yourself? Was that something that you could easily do?
Eventually I did. It was not easy.
It's like people giving themselves shots. At the beginning, it's very difficult, but
yeah,
after a while, they just learn to administer.
I have to say, I gave myself a lot of shots, and that was easier than caring for the Hickman tube. That was kind of a funny situation because I was so frightened by the idea of having that tube in my heart and sticking out of my chest. I wouldn't even look at the thing for, I think, almost 4 months. So I would, at that point, visiting nurses were coming to my parents' house where I was living every 2 days. I would lie down, close my eyes, and the tube would be flushed, and then the site would be dressed. And at the end of it, I would open my eyes and go about my day. But in about the sixth or seventh month, I decided I wanted to go back to college. But one of the prerequisites was my being able to care for my line myself. And so I became more accustomed to it. I looked at it and then learned how to flush and dress it.
And you were able to continue your studies despite this debilitating disease?
I was. As my great neurologist said, Sarah, people go back to college in wheelchairs. You're going to be fine.
It's interesting that, there are these funny little side stories here. You write that one of your nurses had been a cheerleader at your high school. Did you ever tell her that you remembered that she
had done that? Oh, yes, of course. That's actually one of my favorite moments in the story. She appears in the book to insert a bullet of hardened gel into my rectum because I was vomiting. And, it's kind of an intimate thing to happen, but to have some kind of prior relationship with a person doing it just brought it into comedy.
Because while she was doing it, you were remembering her saying, sis, boom, bah, rah, rah, rah.
Maybe not exactly like that, but yes.
It is good that you can laugh about this now.
Hey, it's all you can do. How long did one take?
Before I could laugh?
Oh, I laughed about it right away, but only because I was very interested in posing as this all-powerful 21-year-old, all-powerful force.
But you write about sobbing one night, not out of fear, but out of fright. And I wondered, what is the distinction that you make there between fear and fright?
Well, fright, I understood, I was using it in that passage as a momentary response, a surprised response, a response of shock, and fear being a more looming, anticipatory feeling. And that point in the book that you're referring to is the night following my operation in which I got my fourth chest line implanted. And this was the permanent line that I had for 11 and a half months. And it was, it was big and bloody and horrible to look at, and there was a kind of permanency that it suggested that just frightened me to hell.
You say that you hurt yourself a few times, even broke bones, but you avoided going to the doctor. Had you developed a fear of doctors after all these years of being sick?
It's difficult to characterize. It's not that I was afraid of doctors. I knew that doctors had what I needed, but It was just a deep emotional resistance to being in a hospital and being a patient. And I think I saw into the future, into the catastrophe of being completely helpless, like tied to a bed somewhere, unable to take care of myself or do anything. And I thought, I'm going to prevent that by never going to the doctor again, which was irrational, of course.
College years are a time when young people learn to live independently from their parents and are asserting their independence. And here you are having to come to terms with needing your parents more, needing the help of anyone else who might be available at times of extreme need.
That's true. And I think I overcompensated for that experience of feeling helpless in my early 20s by, again, refusing help from doctors. I walked around with a broken arm for about a week and a half, and it was just my elbow. But, I did things like that to overcompensate, to kind of heal what felt like the wound of having felt weak.
But now you're fully recovered. You look great.
Thank you. Fully recovered. It's always an event on a continuum. Each day is an event on a continuum, and there's no such thing as perfect health. That's something I sort of came to through writing the book. And
what does that mean? Does that mean that you could have a recurrence somewhere down the line?
Yeah, I could always have a recurrence somewhere down the line. I talked with my neurologist recently, and he said, it's been more than 7 years. You're probably in the clear. But I have talked with people who have CIDP, and they say, I had it in my 20s, and then again in my 60s, and then again in my 70s. And then there are people who never have it again. But I think of myself as healthy because I don't live each day anymore anticipating the end of my life or, anticipating the next relapse. It doesn't frighten me anymore.
Where does the title, The Two Kinds of Decay, come from?
The two kinds of decay are your decay and everyone else's.
Sarah Manguso is the author of two volumes of poetry, a short story collection. She was awarded the Rome Prize by the American Academy of Arts and Letters in 2007. Her latest is a memoir called The Two Kinds of Decay. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.